just goes one to two.
Put it on the chair.
Put it on the chair also.
Say that again?
In the mirror. Put it on the chair?
That's what they do in the mirror.
Oh my goodness. And people say we're just copying the mirror. Okay. So firstly, I want to... which time? Do we have Marm Comos? We do.
Do you want one?
Yeah. Is there an extra one?
Yeah.
I want to make
you
sure
could
I
have mine.
Right. No, I don't want to.
Okay, we'll share. This one.
Okay, good. So first I want to thank everybody. I know it's always a difficult night. It's the end of Hanukkah, and people have always family events, and that's okay. So very much appreciate that people were able to come out in honor of my mother's memory, and we'll get right to the shiur. So I'd like to do is begin by first discussing... as we typically do, one halachic aspect of the holiday of Hanukkah and the mitzvah of Neros Hanukkah, and to use that as an introduction to discussing some broader themes about the significance of Hanukkah and the impact that it has not only these 8 days, but throughout the year. The Gemara in Masechet Shabbos, Daf Chaf Aleph on the base. You have the Marm Komos here. I don't know if Robbie is here or not. Is Robbie here?
He's printing a few more.
What's he doing?
He's printing a few more.
Oh, he's printing a few more. So I just want to thank him. As you can see, now you understand why I'm thanking him for taking it upon himself to help put out the Marm Komos. So the Gemara in Masechet Shabbos, Daf Chaf Aleph on the base, explains my Hanukkah. What is the essence of Hanukkah? The way I like to translate it. And the Gemara describes the background of the miracle and why it is that we commemorate these 8 days. V'chafei v'kislei v'yomi d'chanukah t'manya inon, it's number one. D'lo l'mispe b'hon d'lo l'is'anos b'hon. It's very interesting that the way that the Braisa formulates Chanukah right off, and this is going to be our halachic theme of the night, is that it describes Chanukah by describing the amount of days that it is. Moment of thought that at the end, when they determined how it is that one is to commemorate or celebrate Hanukkah, that there would have been an indication, why it is that there were 8 days, or that there were 8 days. Instead, the Braisa just begins as if the 8-day status, if you will, or the fact that this is a lengthy period of celebration is part of the definition of what it is that Hanukkah is all about, as we'll explain. So, b'chapei kislev, yomei d'chanukah t'manya inun. Hanukkah is an 8-day holiday. It sounds like that's part of the definition of what it is. D'lo l'mispe b'hon, u'd'lo l'is'anos b'hon. And there are days in which there should be no eulogies and no fasting. Shekeshenichnesu yivanim l'heichal, when the Greeks entered into the heichal, part of the Beis HaMikdash, which usually is off-limits to most Jews as well. We'll get back to that. Timu kolashmanin shebehechal. So they made ritually impure. They compromised the ritual purity of the shmanim, of the oil. They only found one cruse of oil, which had the imprimatur of the Kohen Gadol. This would have lasted only a single day. Nasabones, a miracle took place. It lasted 8 days. That's why we have the Tamanya Inon, even though it seems to be formulated in a striking way. And then Lashana Acheres, Kiva'um Ba'asa'um, the next year they made it Yomim Tovim, plural, Bahalel Behoda. Not a Yom Tov, but Yomim Tovim, Bahalel Behoda. This is the famous Braisa. Often in these Shiurim lectures, I begin with this Braisa, because there's just so much packed into these few words, which is the nature, the character, the significance of the holiday of Hanukkah. The one that I want to zero in on this evening is the phrase Yomim Tovim, and the plural of Yomim Tovim, and why it is that even before we get to the details, Hanukkah is defined as Yomei D'Chanukah T'manya Inon, the 8 days of Hanukkah. Okay. We know why there are 8 days, but why is it just spoken of in that collective unit kind of a way? So So what does this phrase, Yom Tov, mean? So Rashi, in his Perush on Masechet Shabbos, I didn't produce it here because we could say it in 1 second, says that really the word Yom Tov here is a misnomer. There really isn't the typical implication of a Yom Tov, which is that there's Yisur Malacha, that there's Kedushas HaYom, you make Kiddush on a Yom Tov, you can't do any Malacha. None of that is true when it comes to Chanukah. And really what the Braisa had in mind was not three components, but two. Instead of saying Yom Tov, Hallel, and Hodah, what we're really being told, says Rashi, is that this is a Yom Tov of Hallel and Hodah, which we'll get back to in just a second. What does that mean? But at least the phrase Yom Tov is kind of passed over by Rashi. Later on in Daf Chav Dalet Amud Aleph, Rashi again repeats that the critical, pivotal element of Chanukah to stress, to accentuate, is the fact that there are days of, especially of Hodah. That is Rashi's view. However, the Rambam does not gloss over this term, although he too, obviously, was sensitive to the problem. He too knew that there was no Isur Malacha, that there is no Kedushas Hayom in the normal sense of the term, that you don't make Kiddush on this day. But the Rambam offers a different explanation as to what the word Yom Tov might be. And he has it here in Halacha, Per Gimel, Halacha Gimel. Looks like Rabbi reorganized for me, right? Okay. Mipnei zet kinuch hakomim shebaoso adar. This is Halacha Gimel. Sheyush shmonas hayamim ha'eluv. This is in number two Halacha Gimel. Sheyush shmonas hayamim ha'eluv shetchilasa milev chamish asa b'kislay. Yemei simcha the Hallel u'madlikin bahen haneiros be'erev al piskei abatim chalai v'layla mishmonas halelos laharos u'legalos es hanes. B'yamim elu hena nekroim b'chanuka hein asurim behesped v'tainis kimei purim. So there are several chidushim in the Rambam. I believe last year or 2 years ago we talked about the absence of Hoda'ah and the fact that that seems to be substituted by Hadlakas Neiros. But for tonight, what I'd like to emphasize is the word Simcha. The Rambam obviously understood that Yom Tov refers to the idea or the concept of Simcha. Perhaps this is very important. There were those who, based on Rashi's interpretation, that Yom Tov just refers to Hallel v'Hodah, and there's no status of Yom Tov intrinsically in its own right, came to the conclusion that there's no obligation to feast, there's no obligation to have a Seuda on Chanukah, at least absent Divrei Torah, which would turn it into a Seudas Mitzvah. That was the view of the Maram Rutenberg, and that is accepted by many of the poskim. However, the Marshal and others understood that since the Rambam suggests that the word Yom Tov refers to Simcha, so that might be a reason for there to be a Seuda on this day. It's interesting, and we'll go back to this, that the Poskim were very disturbed by the fact that there is no obligation of Seuda on Chanukah. After all, every other Jewish holiday, right, requires that there be some sort of feast. And none so more, frankly, than Hanukkah's counterpart, Purim. Purim, of course, is not only a day of Simcha, but it's a day of Mishta v'Simcha. The Mishnah, in the final formulation of the Megillah, right, actually precedes the Simcha. Typically, a Simcha triggers a Mishta. And in the case of Purim, the Mishta is so prominent that it's Mishta v'Simcha. And the Poskim were troubled, they were disturbed. How could Chanukah possibly be any different? They gave a very famous answer, which I'm going to get back to in a few minutes. Both the Bach and the Lavush suggested that there's a fundamental difference between Chanukah and Purim. That Purim celebrates the almost annihilation, physical annihilation of the Jewish people. It constitutes, therefore, a physical salvation. And for that reason, it is celebrated in a physical manner by a Seuda. And not only by an Seuda, but a Seuda, a Mishta v'Simcha. However, in Chanukah, the Jews chose to fight. Really, their lives were not in danger. if you're talking about their physical existence. And really, their struggle was an existential, spiritual and existential one. And consequently, when they ultimately, with Hashkachas Hashem, prevailed, so the chosen method of commemorating this particular holiday was not through feasting, an obvious physical expression, but actually through Neiros Chanukah and Hallel and Hodah, which seemed to be more appropriate. That's the explanation. However, since the Rambam does say that there is a din of Simcha on Chanukah, and according to the Marshal and others, they understand the Rambam to be actually promoting the obligation of a Su'uda. Not 100% clear in the Rambam, but that may be the case. So it's interesting to ask the question, what about the reasoning, the very compelling explanation of the Bach and of the Levush? Their explanation has been almost second nature accepted by Klal Yisrael. Seems to make a lot of sense. Does the Rambam disagree with this dichotomy between Purim and Chanukah? And in that respect, it's interesting to note that in this very same Rambam, that the Rambam makes two references in the same halacha to the parallel of Purim. The Rambam says, "V'yamim elu hem hanekra'im Chanukah, v'hein asurim behesped v'tainas kimei Purim," which is really superfluous because any day, as we'll discuss, of Megillas Tanis is already Aser Behesped B'Tanis. Not necessary to invoke Kimei Purim here. Moreover, some of the Mefarshim were troubled because the prohibition of Hesped B'Tanis is in the Megillah itself. Maybe it's even of a different level than that of Chanukah. And then the Rambam says, V'hadlakas ha-neiros bahen mitzvah midivrei sofrim kikriyas ha-megillah. Another equation. Now, the Rambam mentions the phrase midivrei sofrim many, many times in Yad HaChazakah. There are numerous examples of it. Even in Hilchos Chanukah, Purim B'Chanukah, he's going to tell you that there's another mitzvah midivrei sofrim, Hallel. So it's curious that, he didn't leave it alone just to say that it's a mitzvah midivrei sofrim. He adds, mitzvah midivrei sofrim, kriyas ha-megillah. When the Rambam speaks about who is obligated in Chanukah, he speaks again about the parallel between Chanukah and Purim and the Megillah. It seems that the Rambam was equating the two. And of course, structurally, the Rambam made a very interesting decision when he created a section called Hilchos Megillah v'Chanukah, right, in which he focuses on these two mitzvahs, and also on the mitzvah of Hallel, but primarily on Megillah and Chanukah. It seems as if the Rambam was trying to equate these two institutions, notwithstanding the very fundamental differences between them. Maybe by putting them together, the Rambam also was able to accentuate some of their differences. But certainly, the Rambam's perspective that Yom Tov here means Simcha, the possibility that there is also reference to Seuda, that it may imply Seuda, and the Rambam's link between Chanukah and Purim is certainly very significant. Let's take this a step further. After all, we should ask ourselves the question whether for Rashi, and especially for the Rambam, right, why do we use this phrase Yom Tov? Even if in the end of the day it refers to Simcha, and maybe Simcha and Seuda, is Yom Tov an appropriate term for a Chag D'Rabbanan? We don't typically call Purim a Yom Tov. Again, Yom Tov has the association of Kedushas Hayom, of Yisur Malacha, the very reasons that militated against Rashi counting it as a separate component, right, should have, encouraged, should have motivated the Brisa to find a more accurate term. It seems like the formulation of Yom Tov was intentional, and that notwithstanding the fact that this is an unconventional Yom Tov, this seems, the status of Chanukah as a Yom Tov appears to be something which, again, is important to understanding its character, its nature, and its implications. Let's go a step further. This idea that it is a Yom Tov of some sort, notwithstanding an unconventional one, is reinforced by the fact that we make a Shechayanu, a Zman. We associate Zman with Yom Tov. We also say the Brach of Shechayanu Zman in other instances, but certainly when it comes to holidays, we associate it not just with the fact that it's ba mipam lapam or mizman lazman, but with the idea of a Yom Tov status, a Kedushas Hayom status. The truth is that normally this association with Moed should be challenged in this particular context. What I want to examine very briefly is whether or not we say Zman on Chanukah only because of the mitzvah of Neros Chanukah, or is the actual period B'chafei Kislev Tmanya Yomei the Chanukah Inun, the period of Chanukah, also require Zman. And that, of course, would be something very sensational. It would imply that this tkufa, this period, is more than just a commemoration of a particular nace or even of a particular victory. So in order to understand this better, let's look very quickly at some of the evidence. The Gemara on Daf Chav Gimel Amud Aleph in Masechet Shabbos, which we have here on page 2, says, Amar Rav Chiya, this is number 7, Amar Rav Chiya Barashi Amar Rav, Amad L'Kneir Shul Chanukah Tzorech Levarech. When you light the candles of Chanukah, you make a bracha. Rav Yirmiya Amar Haroa Ner Shul Chanukah Tzorech Levarech. Amar Rav Yehuda Yom Rishon Haroa Mevarech Shtayim Amad L'Kneir Mevarech Gimel. On the first day, if a person lights, he has his own home, he has his own menorah, he'll make 3 brachos. And he can ve'elach, madlik mevarech shtayim, baroa mevarech achas. Then the Gemara says, and this is the interesting part, mai memait, memait zman. And the Gemara says, and v'nimot neis. The Gemara says, neis kol yom isa. Basically what happened in the Gemara is as follows. The Gemara says that you make 3 brachos on the first night. You make a lahadlik ner shol Chanukah, sh'asa nisan la'vaseinu. You make those brachos every night. And then on the first night, you also make shechiyam, our practice. But then the Gemara says something very strange. The Gemara says, why should you drop the bracha of Zman on the other days? Maybe you should say it every single day. Which one do you drop? So the Gemara says, well, you drop Zman. The Gemara says, why should you drop Zman? Maybe you should drop the Birchas Haroah, sh'asa nisan. That seems to be doubly puzzling. Why would you not say Birchas Haroah on the other days? And why would you think that you could substitute Zman for Birchas Haroah? It seems as if the Gemara had a thought that this tkufa, again, of Shmona Simei Chanukah, right, is not just significant from the beginning and then it lingers on or it lasts. There's the first day and it continues. But that each day constitutes a renewal of this period, a kind of Kedushas HaZman. And the truth is that that is very surprising. Where do we find anywhere else where we have multiple Shehechiyanus? In Doraisa, certainly not. The one time, of course, I'm not talking about Yantav Sheni Shel Golios, and then there's, of course, the controversy about Rosh Hashanah, which is a Yom Arichta. But otherwise, typically, you don't have day after day of Zman. Why did the Gemara think that there should be a particular affinity for Zman when it comes to Chanukah, to Manya Inu? And indeed, there might be other echoes of this idea that every single day of Chanukah is independently significant, and that the collective period of Chanukah in an integrated fashion is a total period, a total Zman. For example, Gemara says in Masechet Erchin, Daf Yud Amud Aleph, that the Gemara there counts the days in which we say full challah, gomrim bahem asahala. And among them, in the regular holidays, is every day of Sukkot. We don't say whole halal every day of Pesach, as is known, but we do say whole halal, as we're experiencing now, every single day of Chanukah. And the question is why? And the Rishonim give different answers. The Abudram explains that the reason that every single day of Chanukah deserves its own halal is because every single day of halal has a chiddush. There's something unique, there's a new nair. Every single day constitutes a separate dimension of that particular holiday. He compares it to Sukkot. In Sefer Pardes, in the Beis Medrash of Rashi, they have other suggestions, maybe because of Pesumei Nisa, some to avoid, obviously, this idea that every day of Chanukah constitutes an independent kiyum or chiyum. Let's take it a step further. In fact, Rav Parachia, one of the she does Kadmonim on Masechet Shabbos. I believe I have it here somewhere. Number 8. Says something remarkable about this Gemara. And maybe he was influenced by suggestion before that this Gemara is written, you know, with a bit of a peculiar slant. We noted that the Gemara makes a suggestion that maybe you'd make a zman every single day, maybe you could drop the Birchas Haroah and keep the zman. So a Parachya, in explaining the halacha, which is that you only make zman on the first day, says, Aval zman kulu kechad yoma richa dami. He says the reason that you only make one zman is not because, as we normally encounter, you always make the zman the first time you do it. Not that the zman lingers on and applies to every other performance. The way Parakya says it is that the entire period of Chanukah is a Yoma Arichta. And then he says, "Umeha nirali the shnei yomim tovim shal Rosh Hashanah, kiven shem kedusha achas ukiyom echad aroch, he nechshavim lo mevarchin zman ele belayla harishon bilvad." Wow. We're all familiar with Yom HaRichta in Rosh Hashanah. Before Rav Parachya, I don't think any of us were familiar with this concept anywhere else, certainly not in Chanukah. But what's implied again is this idea that the entire tkufa of Chanukah, Yomei Temanya Inun, is a single period infused or suffused with special status as a special zman, as a kind of a Yom Tov. In the Sefer Pardes, not the one of Sifras de Rashi, but of the Talmud of the Rajba, Rabbi Ephraim ben Chaim, he has a very remarkable line, very similar to this Rabbeinu Parachya, if you have it here on number 9. He talks about a different issue, the issue of whether or not you should make a Shechianu on Bir Chametz. When you do Bir Chametz, should you make a Shechianu or not? We don't. He says, "L'fizek kasha, ma'ilom mevarchin and shechayonu b'bir chametz kibin shum mizman mizman." And he gives several answers. If you could skip down just a few two lines, "V'yesh mishakasav shatam hu legabe bir mishum dadayin lo nigmar hamitzvah shadayin sorach bitol." Maybe the reason there's no zman is because it's an elongated mitzvah. It doesn't really end when you think it ends, because after all, the bitul is really part of the biur, and you do that much later. Therefore, there's no zman because you can't find a moment, right, a narrowly defined moment, and therefore there's no zman. So the Sefer Pardes rejects this explanation for the following reason: the Ein Zanachon, Sharei B'Chanukah B'Laila Rishon Mevarchin Zman Alfa Pishalo Nigmar Hamitzvah Yom Shmini. You make a brach on the first night, and the mitzvah isn't over until the eighth day. Once again, it's this same perspective, very fascinating perspective, which is not that you keep doing the mitzvah again and again, like you go when you sit in the sukkah again and again, right, and so on, but that there is a period, an eight-day period of Chanukah that begins at the first minute and that ends when it's all over. Very interesting. Indeed, this also is reflected in another source, not in terms of the tkufa of zman, so it's a little bit less powerful, but in the position of the Ravon. Ravon, number 10, discusses the question why it is that some brachos are formulated al, other brachos are formulated le. So, for example, should you say al neiros chanukah, or should you say lahadlik ner shel chanukah? We know that we say lahadlik ner shel chanukah. So the Ravon's rule is Bram. Tzrichin anu lemeliv tam amayam rina bebiktas brachos al kagod al amila al ashkita al achilas matza al achilas marar al bir chametz al pidyon aben al kisei adam al tilas sulav and so on al mikra megillah utikavaseyon ubemiktas brachos lo amrina behu al kagod leisha basuka lusata. But the last one that he mentions, of course, is lahadlik ner shel chanukah utikavaseyon. The tamid mistaber li Eliezer. Ligabe, he's talking about himself. Me, Eliezer, I think about this. The kol bracha sheyal ma'isa davar echad shasiyasa shalosa davar lefishav v'nigmar mitzvah bosa ma'isa mevarich al. Whenever the mitzvah is targeted, narrow, defined, it's over. When it's over, you say al. The chain lahadlik ner shel chanukah, on the other hand, shekol halelos levad milayla rishon yesh po neiros lahadlik ולא נגמרה מצוות שמדליק כל הנרות, והכי מברך להדליק, דמשמע להדליק כל נר ונר, ולא חילקו ברכה ללילה הראשון משאר הלילות. Another expression of the same idea, that this is a long period, at least with regard to the hadlakos, according to the Rabban, and that justifies the nusach habracha being le instead of al. This question of how we look at this entire period has impact on other issues as well. What if you don't say Shehechiyanu on the first night of Chanukah? Can you say it afterwards or not? So this is an interesting discussion in the Rishonim again. It's not explicit in the Gemara. And I think I've put here the Shibbele Aleke. Look at the Shibbele Aleke discusses two questions. I want to discuss the second one, so I'm guessing that that is on page 3. And the formulation here is very important. Ani Akir, this is about four lines down on page 3. Ani Akar Yeshli Lishol She'ela Zu. A person's on the road, he's not anywhere near a menorah, and he misses the first night. Does he make a shechiyanu after the first night? Listen to this. He should make a bracha if he can't do it the first night, the next available night. Because this is what we say about Yomim Tovim. That's why I'm interested in this formulation. With regard to Yomim Tovim, we typically say, Zman Omro Afila Bishuk, Da Afila Kol Shiva, Odilma Kivin Dilo Barich, Bizmano Bilelio Rish Kalaman, Kama, Lo Livarich Klal, Mishnach Omro Chachamim, the language of the Gemara is, Hamadlik Bilarish Mivarich Gimel, Haroa Mivarich Shtayim, Adkan Devarim. And then he says, Rabbeinu Yeshaya, Kosov, She'en Listapik V'davar, Devadai Chayiv Levarech, Shalom Mitzvah Habal L'Adam, Mishana L'Shana Chayiv Levarech. He ends up saying that of course you have to make the bracha, and he somewhat dilutes the significance of the question. But in the question itself, which also appears in Sifras de Berashi, it's always formulated in this exact way. Do we zero in on the hadlaka about which the Gemara seems to provide extra emphasis on the first night? Or should we treat this like we treat Yomim Tovim, about which the Gemara says in Eruvin, on Daf Mem Amud Aleph, about Zman Omro Afila Bishuk? Sounds like the Rishonim were really trying to figure out whether or not there is a real status of Moed, of Yom Tov, when it comes to this particular halacha. If indeed Zman is connected to the period, would we ever go so far as to say that you could say Zman on the period of Chanukah, even if it's divorced from the Hadlaka itself? So this is a question that comes up as well in the following circumstance. Typically, the Shulchan Aruch Paskins like these Rishonim, Paskins that Lahalaka, you do say Zman even if it's not the first day. However, there are several questions that arise. For example, what will happen if a person is not able to light candles the first day, but they light for him at home? So he fulfills the mitzvah of Hadlakas Ner Chanukah, and the question is, does he have to repeat the Shechiyanu or not? He himself never said Shechiyanu, but Shechiyanu is connected to the Hadlakah with which he was Yotze. So it seems that this is a major machlokas between the Rishonim. The Rashba, for example, says that if a person fulfills the mitzvah of Hadlakas Ner Chanukah, even though he wasn't there, he didn't experience it, but his wife, his family lit for him, that he will not make the bracha of Roesh, also Nisam Lavoseinu. And it sounds like the Rashba thinks that he will never say Shechiyanu either. In other words, Shechiyanu is always going to be linked to the Hadlakas Ner Chanukah. But the Magen Avraham in Orach Chaim is not sure. He thinks that maybe there's a difference between Birchas HaRoash, Asa Nisim, and the Bracha of Zman. Even though you fulfilled the obligation of Hadlaka, and that was Mitzurah, that was connected to a Birchas HaZman, since you never said Zman, maybe you're obligated to say it again. But it goes a step further than that. The Meiri is of the opinion that if a person is traveling, And he is nowhere near a menorah, and he doesn't fulfill the obligation. No one at home is lighting for him. He misses that night completely. So the Meiri was of the opinion that that individual should make the Birchas HaRoeh, and he should also make Shechiyanu. I should say it the other way. He should make a Shechiyanu, and he should make the Birchas HaRoeh, even though the Shechiyanu, and in this case the Roeh as well, we'll leave that for another time, is completely disconnected from Neros Chanukah. And the Mishnah Berurah, in the Shara Tzion, suggests that you should rely on that Meiri in a situation where you don't have any other choice. Here he says, just very quickly, Shulchan Aruch number 12, Amadlik b'leil rishon mevarech gimel brachos, lahadlik ner Chanukah sha'asa nisim shechiyanu, v'im lo birek zman b'leil rishon mevarech b'leil sheni o kishiyizkar. This psak, that if you don't say zman on the first night, you say it when you can. The Mishnah Berurah here, other poskim say, o kishiyizkar, rotzalomer kishiyizkar b'shar leilos b'shas hadlaka, preferably when you're lighting one of the other days. Bimniskar achar hadlaka, ena mavarech, but you wait another day. Like it's the third night, you could say zman, but it's too late, you already lit. You wait till the fourth day. But then in the Shaar Tzion, he says, here, just skip down, it's number 14. Amnam, im irazeh belel shmini, if it's the last night, and he's already lit, umimeli yizbata legamri bircha shechiyanu, tzarchiyum. Efshir de kamo ba'alma kaimelon de zman omra filo b'shuk. You say Zman, even if it's disconnected from, you say Zman on the Birchas HaZman, on the Kiddush HaZman itself. Du koyal etzem hayom tov, efshar dehu adid bazeh, du koyal etzem hazman de Chanukah, shenasevo nisim v'niflos, ele de lechatchila samchu al zman de hadlaka, ukein svarasi nimse b'meiri, v'zeh leshono, and then he quotes this tremendous chiddush of the Meir. Of course, this is the climax of this idea, the idea that you would actually say Birchas HaZman, that you would talk about the so-called Yom Tov status of Chanukah, even if it was completely disconnected from the Hadlaka. The question is, what do we mean then about Yom Tov? Obviously, there seems to be quite a few sources that imply whether it's within the perspective that it has to be connected to the Hadlaka, and even more radically, in some cases, disconnected from the Hadlaka, that the period of Chanukah itself, these days are set aside as Yomim Tovim of some sort. Not a conventional Yom Tov, but a Yom Tov nonetheless. The Orchas Chaim, Kolbo, even suggests, responding to the famous Beis Yosef question, why do we celebrate 8 days and not seven? After all, there was a Pach Shemen for one day. He suggests that the eight-day period represents the theme of Bris Milah. I think I have this here somewhere. First page.
Source 5.
What number?
5.
Okay, great. In Toma Halones Lohoya Lazayin Yamin Dovad. Right, so he has an answer. Then the next second line, the Ist Amri Tam Acher She'oz. One second. Kincho Bais Me'avodah Shabit Lo Hayivanim. Habala itim kosav tamacher lama shmona yamim shebitlu mehem mitzvas mila shehila shmona lefikach kavu shmonas yamim. We'll get back to that in just a few minutes. But again, this implies that quite separate from the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah, that there are other themes that took place in the context of this struggle, this epic struggle to extricate themselves from the Yavanim, that are worthy of celebration and of commemoration. Indeed, going back to the question, even for Rashi, what does it mean to speak of a Yom Tov of Hallel and Hodah? And for the Rambam, what does it mean for there to be a Yom Tov which expresses itself in Simcha, maybe even in physical Simcha? What does it mean that the Zman and that the Hadlaka would encompass a chunk of time, an eight-day period, reflected in Hallel, Zman, the Hadlaka of neighbors? I think that the answer, generally speaking, is very simple but very, very important. What it implies is that while the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah certainly symbolically embodied what it was that the struggle, what motivated the struggle, what undergirded the struggle symbolically, the mitzvah of Chanukah and the tkufa of celebration of Chanukah, the Yom Tov of Chanukah, if you will, represents something far more significant. And for that reason, Chanukah has taken hold the way that it has in the consciousness of Klal Yisrael. After all, there are a host of questions asked by some of the most important Mefarshim. This entire focus on Ner Chanukah seems to defy any kind of comparable analogy. Typically, we don't make Yomim Tovim because of the ability to perform a particular mitzvah, right? The mitzvah may have been superfluous, and on and on. More importantly, Gemara says in Masechet Rosh Hashanah that there's a debate whether the list of holidays that commemorated miracles, known as Megillas Tanis, was batel or not. Gemara has two views on this matter. I have it here in Rosh Hashanah Daf Yud Ches Amud Beis. Number three, Itmar Rav Rav Chanin Amri, batel Megillas Tanis, Rav Yochanan Rav Yeshua Ben Levi Amri, lo batel Megillas Tanis, Rebbe Rav Chin Amri, batel Megillas Tanis, Hachi Kamar. And then the Gemara goes on. But then the Gemara, the continuation, if you look four lying down, Masa Rav Kana, Maisa V'Gazru Tainas B'Chanukah V'Lud, somebody, imposed a fast day in Lud on Chanukah, V'Yard Rav Elazar V'Rachatz. And Rav Elazar defied this Gzeira, and Rav Yeshua also, the Sefer, Amar Lahem, and they said, Tzu V'Yis'anu Al Mashi Yis'anesem. You should fast for having fasted, meaning you defiled the day of Chanukah, the Yom Tov of Chanukah, we'll call it. Amar Rav Yosef, so the question is, batel Megillas Tanis, lo batel Megillas Tanis. If batel Megillas Tanis, what's so terrible about making Chanukah into a fast day? So the Gemara says, Amar Rav Yosef, shayni Chanukah, de'ika mitzvah. And then the Gemara says, Amar Labai v'tivatel ihi v'tivatel mitzvasa. Amar Rav Yosef, shayni Chanukah, de'befarsim anisa. A very ambiguous Gemara. One thing is clear from the Gemara, and that is that while Megillas Tanis, that whole list of miracle-motivated celebrations or festivals, while that list no longer exists, there are exceptions, Purim and Chanukah. Now, Purim is an exception because it's part of Kisvei HaKodesh. There may even be hints at it in the Torah itself, according to the Gemara in Megillah. Clearly, it's a Takanas HaNeviim. Why is Chanukah an exception? And you see, the Gemara is struggling here and not telling us very much. The Ika Mitzvah Pirsumei Nisa, etc. The question remains stronger than the few words that the Gemara gives to answer. We need to understand the Gemara's answer. Why is Chanukah the single exception to the extinction of Megillas Tanis? Moreover, if we analyze the sources, it seems clear that Chanukah is unique. Chanukah is singular in the way that it is presented. I'll just mention one, just to highlight it. The Rambam in Hilchos Megillah, Perek Gimel Halacha Aleph, begins with history. This is on page 1, number 2. The Rav Zatzal always noted this. Kedarko, who's a super expert in the Rambam, he noted that almost never do we find the Rambam providing historical background. And yet here, Bebayis Sheni, Kishemochu Yavon, Gozruk Zeres al Yisrael, Bitudatom, Lo Nicho Asom Lasok Torah B'Mitzvos, Pashto Yodim B'Mamonom, B'Binoseim, B'Nichtesu Lehecho Parts of Oprotzos, B'Tim Toharos, B'Tzor Lehen L'Yisrael Ma'od Mipneim, B'Lachatzom Lachatz Godol, This whole halacha of the Rambam is very out of, I would say, uncharacteristic. Normally the Rambam doesn't provide historical background, and the Rav simply noted that in parallel, since this is Hilchos Megillah v'Chanukah, And as I noted before, the Rambam keeps equating between Megillah and Chanukah, right? Talked about this the other day. So it's particularly striking because in the case of Purim, we don't have historical background. The Rav thought that the answer was simple. He thought that the very fact that Megillah has Kisvei HaKodesh, and that's what we read on Purim, that is the historical background. Chanukah, there's no Kisvei HaKodesh, there's no Nevi'im, therefore we need to be brought up to speed in terms of the background. And I'm sure that that is absolutely true. But it doesn't explain some aspects of this presentation. For example, the Rambam providing the background here seems to extend beyond what we know from the Gemara and even from the Medrash. And he uses phraseology, which, if you know the Rambam's terminology elsewhere, is fraught with all sorts of significance. So bitlu daitam is a reference that appears also in Perikei, Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, when he speaks about the concept of shas hashmad, the obligation to martyr yourself in a time of religious crisis, even if you're not faced with the ultimate decision of the Gimel Averos, of Arizara Gilei Arayos Shvichos Damim. The phrase bitlu daitam in the Rambam is a loaded phrase. And once you say bitlu daitam, why do you need to say the next ones? Velo hinichu osam lasok b'torah b'mitzvos. That seems redundant. U'pashtu yadam b'mamonam u'bibnosehem also is not so clear where that came from. Clearly, in addition to providing background so you understand better what this holiday is all about, the Rambam seems to be substantively trying to convey to us that there was more than simply a struggle for existence, maybe even more than a struggle against spiritual extinction. Sounds like what the Rambam is trying to tell us is that what's important about the background of Chanukah is that there was a Kulturkampf, that there was a cultural battle between the Jews and the Greeks. And that that cultural conflict expressed itself in multiple ways, that it constituted a danger for Klal Yisrael, for its very way of life, and that consequently, the salvation is something to be celebrated almost as like a physical salvation, because Jews can't live without Torah way of life, a halachic way of life. In other words, that spiritual extinction is as bad, possibly worse. Bitlu daitam, the idea of shas hashmad and yehorig v'yabar, quality of spiritual life, is something which is worth perhaps more even than physical life. In other words, what the Rambam and others are trying to indicate is that while the struggles of the Chashmonaim and the magnitude and the character of the victory is embodied and reflected by the Neis Pach HaShemen, in the end, it's only symbolized by that. There's a certain Yom Tov status to Tmanya Inun, to these 8 days of Chanukah, because in a bigger way, it commemorates something that is at the core of life itself, quality of life, from a Jewish point of view. And consequently, while it expresses itself l'chatchila in Ner Chanukah, in some cases it goes beyond Ner Chanukah to the commemoration of the period itself. Or to take a step back and to go back to the comments of the Labush and the Bach. The Labush and the Bach were trying to explain a very narrow issue. They simply wanted to know why it is that in Chanukah, right, as opposed to any other festival, right, there isn't a physical feast that commemorates, right, this particular Yom Tov. And their explanation is an excellent explanation. It traces the difficulties, the danger to spiritual causes, and suggests that therefore a spiritual salvation requires a spiritual manifestation in terms of the miracle. What I'm trying to suggest is that we take what they say a giant or several giant steps forward and suggest that really the cultural clash between the Yavanim and Klal Yisrael was a clash about spirituality itself. It was essentially an attack on the notion of Kedusha, and especially how Kedusha is expressed from a halachic point of view in terms of Kavod HaAdam and everything that goes along with it. And for that reason, while Batla Megillas Tainis, Chanukah, because of the stakes involved, because it really represents the core and essence of what makes Yadus unique, is something which could never be batel. And while there are, on the surface, excellent reasons to distinguish between Purim and Chanukah, because it's Merumas B'daraisa, it has the Kisvei HaKodesh, it's Takanas HaNeviim, nonetheless, what was at stake at Chanukah was of such magnitude that maybe Chanukah is the equal, maybe even in some respects, superior to Megillah. Certainly, it deserves to share the stage with Megillah in the Rambam's Hilchos Chanukah Upur. And if this is the case, then what we should do is try to identify what the Gzeros of the Yavanim were, whether there is a pattern that ties them together in terms of a kind of cultural program or a cultural attack on Klal Yisrael, and then to understand what the halachic perspective negating that is all about and why the stakes were as high as they were. It's fascinating that we find numerous different reports regarding this issue. If you look here in Masechet Sofrim, in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, this is number 3 and number 4, leaving off where I left off last time. The Gemara says, Mosiv Rav Acha Barhuna, B'tlasa B'tishrei B'telis Adkarta Min Shtaraya, She'gazer Malchus Yavon Shmad Shelo Lahaske Shem Shemayim Al Piyem. The Greeks made a takana, right? They made a gzera that you are no longer allowed to mention Shem Hashem. Obviously, very peculiar kind of a gzera, but a very pervasive limitation on Klal Yisrael. Ukeshegabru Malchus Chashmonai V'Nitzchum Hitkinu Shiu Mazkirin Shem Shemayim Afilu B'Shtaros. The Kachi Kosvim B'Shana Kach V'Kach Liyochanan Koin Gadol L'Kel Elyon. They used to, you know, when they succeeded, when they won the victory, so not only did they reinstitute the ubiquitous use of Shem Hashem, but they used it commercially as well. Ukeshashamu chachamim b'davar amru l'machar ze pareis chova v'nimsa shtar mutal b'yashba u'bitlum v'osa yom aso yom tov. They made a yom tov for that. In other words, there was a corrective and a corrective of the corrective. The Greeks made it zera that Shem Hashem could no longer be used. Klal Yisrael, you know, instituted Shem Hashem even in commercial documents, and the Chachamim felt that that was too much. Technically, that could end up in the Ashba. I think metaphorically, what they were saying is, you know, Shem Shemayim, for it to play the role that we needed to play, for it to be a central linchpin in Kedushas Yisrael, in Torah itself, is something that we have to protect against trivialization as well. You don't write it on a shtar if it's going to end up in the Ashba. What is this whole struggle about Shem Hashem? The next Gemara, number 4. Masad Rav Tuvi Bar Masna V'esrim Utsmanya Bey Asa B'sorta Tavta Lihudai V'lo Yidun Midoraisa. They could learn, they weren't warned against learning. Shegzazra Malchus Harsha Shmad Al Yisrael Shelo Yasku B'Torah. Okay, Lashkicham Torah Secha, we're familiar with that. But also Shelo Yamulu as B'neim, what was referred to as responsible for the 8 days according to the Or HaChaim, Mila, v'sheichalu shabbosos, more of the program of Gzeros, Chil Shabbos, Bris Mila, of course, Esek B'Torah u'B'Mitzvos. The Abu Dram, commenting on the words in Alanisim, Lahabiram mi'chukei Ritzonecha, says that Chukei Ritzonecha refer to Shabbos, Mila, and Rosh Chodesh. Interesting. In Masechet Midos, Perek Beis Mishnah Gimel, number 16, this is on page 3. This is just en passant, just very Siach Lepituma. The Mishnah is describing the structure of the Beis HaMikdash. Lifnim imenu soreg, gavoa asara tvachim, a soreg that was 10 tvachim high, v'shlosha se pirtzos hayusham, there were 13 holes or gaps in this soreg, shepirtzu malche yavan, 13 times they breached the soreg. Chozer v'gadrum, v'gazru kenegdam, yud gimel hishtachavayos. They stopped them up, they mended them, and then they also instituted 13 hishtachavayos, times to do bikareo mishtachave, in the mikdash, keneged these 13 breaches. What is this idea of breach making, and what is this idea of hishtachavayos? In other words, if you look carefully, and there are more, the Rambam has the idea of the fact that they defiled the daughters of Klal Yisrael. Right? Rashi commenting on Afen Hayuba Osones in Masechet Shabbos, Daf Chav Gimel Amud Aleph, says that the Greeks instituted a policy that whenever a Besulas Yisrael was about to get married, that they insisted that she would first be defiled by one of their generals. Obviously a cynical, hateful, egregious kind of conduct. Well, why is that part of the Greek program, the Xeros of the Yevanim against Klal Yisrael? That, of course, is what the Rambam probably is referring to as well. If we look at the pattern of Xeros, if we look at the way that halachic literature understands the challenges, it appears that a critical pattern emerges. And that is the pattern that I made allusion to before. There appears to have been a programmatic, concerted, focused effort by the Yevanim to undermine the pillars of halachic society, particularly the concept of kedusha, of sanctity. And it expressed itself in these numerous ways. To understand this better, we really need to take one step back very quickly to understand what Greek culture really was. And of course, I need to qualify what I'm about to say. Greek culture was diverse, and it changed over time. But I'll go with the analysis of Robert Giuseppe, who wrote a lot on Greek thought, which is that notwithstanding the changes that took place, there were certain hallmark characteristics of Greek culture which mostly dominated for these centuries and which constitute a certain pattern. In his opinion, the comment by Protagoras, or the comment that is often imputed to him, man is the measure of all things, a pithy statement, we're not even really sure if he said it, may be the most important or the most characteristic of their philosophy. The Sophists embodied a particularly human-centered ideology, perspective on life. Man is the measure of all things, of course, reflects this. And though, afterwards, this was modified in a pragmatic way, but that skepticism, that relativism, which mostly defined Greek thought, was something that was never completely abandoned. Even in the time and in the works of Plato and Aristotle, where natural law and there being some sort of objective truth and reality became to be the prevailing positions, nonetheless, the idea that the world is here to serve mankind, that man is the center of the universe, the essentially elimination of spirituality in the sense of the Ribbono Shel Olam, transcendence from the picture, is something which mostly characterized Greek thought. Let me just take a couple of minutes, a few bullet points. religious orientation or theology. The Greeks initially at least believed in spirits of nature, which, as everybody knows, they elevated into a system of what they called gods and goddesses, which in fact were an unruly assemblage of rivals called deities, but who basically patronized diverse and especially discrete human activities. They focused on, or they were defined by, what we understand to be human needs almost exclusively, and their purpose was human-centered. Stories about the Greek gods, with a small g, illustrate human qualities, not divine qualities. The gods were jealous, the gods were lustful, the gods were sneaky. They were essentially powerful, immortal humans. How much of a contrast is that to the notion of anti-anthropomorphism? We take the view, Dibra Torah Kilashon B'nei Adam. We take mostly the view of the Rambam, the view of negative theology. We can't even describe the Ribbono Shel Olam because we don't have the tools, we don't have the language to do so. He and his name are ineffable. Instead of a imitatio Dei that is top-down, one might say, which is our system of life, Mahu Rachum, Mahu Chanun, the system of Greek culture was bottom-up. It was human form. Essentially, the gods were immortal, powerful human beings. There was no spiritual needs, no ultimate telos, and, of course, no concept of Yichud Hashem, an integration, a balance, everything flowing and radiating from one HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Instead, you had these discrete rivals squabbling among themselves, competitive and petty, and the opposite direction of imitatio Dei. Because of that theological perspective, there was heavy emphasis in Greek intellectual life on politics, governing human beings. Philosophy, of course, was the great contribution, intellectual contribution of Greek society, disentangled from, often at odds with, the domination of any kind of religious impulse. For this reason, you had a fascination with political thought. Of course, ultimately found its best expression, most powerful expression in Plato's Republic, but all the Greek thinkers spent a lot of time envisioning the ideal system of human governance. Ethics, if it couldn't derive from religious sources, constituted a discrete field of study parallel to that of politics. It wasn't surprising that, at least initially, ethical systems promoted by the Greeks were pragmatic and utilitarian, even if they were purely rationalistic. In the end, the impulses of Plato and Aristotle certainly idealized these, rationalized them, moderated them. But in the end of the day, not because of any kind of spiritual or divine anchor, but simply as that which is either intellectually compelling or pragmatically effective for human beings. The hedonistic excesses of the gods were often portrayed as a counterpoint to the rationalistic trends of the Greek intellectuals. Austere, aesthetic, Stoics also were not rooted in religious thought, but again in a certain kind of efficient behavioral kind of structure of life. Utility shaped an immense contribution to the political world. Which led to the third point, and that is that rationalism itself became the religion of Greek intellectuals. Rationalism that was unbounded, unfettered, that ended up promoting arrogance and skepticism of any kind of received religious wisdom, that promoted skepticism. Again, nothing could be more far from a system of Mesorah, of Emunah, of Bitachon. from a concept of chukei ritzonecha, which speaks about an inner logic, a logic that is defined by Torah law and by a Torah reality. Platonic forms, which are idealistic, parallel, in some respects, this idea of chukei ritzonecha, but they are kirchok mizrach bimarav from it, because the root of one, halachic norms, is divine and transcendent, and that creates its own inner reality, whereas Platonic forms was Plato's very brilliant way of coming to grips with the evidence, the philosophical evidence of cosmology and of life itself. The eclipsing of worship and rationality could be found in one other area of Greek activity, and that was the outsized emphasis on art and literature. This, too, reflects a human centrism, an anthropocentrism, which is such a contrast to Yadus. You have primitive religious motifs in their art and the sculpture, temples, statues, plays and statues of gods, but more telling and more sensual, human-centered, realistic, or physically exaggerated, perfected portrayals of the human form. Again, what for us is axiomatically Avodah Zarah, or certainly borders on Avodah Zarah, was for them the celebration of the ideal of life. The gods for them played kind of foils to the human condition. And this is true not only in sculpture and art, but also in the focus of their literature. The Iliad and the Odyssey, dramatic through excess, even though there's a lot there that is fascinating, there's a lot about self-sacrifice and heroism, but the Greek hero is not somebody who is covetous Yitzro. He's somebody who is an epic figure, an outsized figure, kind of an exhibitionist, even a admirable exhibitionist. So it's sculpture, architecture, literature, all of this reflected human centrism and a neglect of, an implicit rejection of any kind of serious spirituality. Indeed, the comedies alongside the tragedies of the literary output of Greece, in the worst way, I guess, highlighted the phenomenon that is completely antithetical to any religious impulse of dignity and of sanctity, laden with obscenity and ridicule, and so on and so forth. In the end of the day, Greek contribution to society was vast. The Rav, in the end of the Halachic Mind, has a very beautiful passage in which he suggests that the melding of Greek and Jewish philosophy is a creative and a productive chapter in the history of Yahadus and the Jewish people. But only because it was tempered and integrated against the background which was so antithetical with it, was it able to have that kind of an impact. If we turn and contrast this to halachic thought, the halachic thought, which I think most particularly was under siege in the Gzeros of Yavon, and is the reason for this heightened sense of urgency, not just spiritual extinction, but the concept of spirituality as a notion itself, then I think we can appreciate better what Hanukkah is all about. The central theme in Yahadus is the theme of Lehidamos. It's a God-centric way of life. We believe that the Ribbono Shel Olam is desirous of us having a relationship with him, and that he's provided the means, the vehicle, the Torah, mitzvos, which accomplish the impossible, but the necessary. The centrality of Kedusha, understood with all of its complexity and ambition, embodies the central aspiration of every Jew. Through the Torah to achieve the theologically impossible bond with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is existentially, as I say, necessary to develop a meaningful relationship and meaning and purpose in life. Cultivating a spirituality that is anchored in and further develops one humanity and dignity is the true singular contribution of halachic thinking. In most cultures that believe in sanctity and religion, it ends up reducing to asceticism, self-abnegation, right? You drive away the physical for the spiritual. What's unique about the concept of Kedusha from a halachic point of view is that the goal is to develop this kesher, to sanctify and to elevate the human, but there's also recognition not only that that can happen, but only through the dignity of human existence can true sanctity ultimately be achieved. The goal of divine-centric is axiomatic, but singular characteristic is that this is achieved not at the expense of, but as a cultivation of a distinctly human potential. The Rav, in the beginning of halachic man, Ish Halacha, describes three types: religious man, as he calls him, rationalist man, and halachic man. And basically, it portrays these three ideas. Religious man is often an ascetic or a mystic, somebody who is on flight from this world, trying to escape, right, the limitations of his physicality. There's much that is admirable about him, but he falls short of the ambition and the achievements of halachic man. Rational man is somebody who's completely anchored in the material world, even if, like, I'm adding, Plato, he acknowledges that there are greater ideals and even a greater reality, the world of forms or something like it. But halachic man, every Jew, is somebody who brings spirituality into the world and who advances spirituality in the process. Gemara says in Masechet Shabbos that the Malachim also wanted the Torah, but their plea was rejected because of the distinctly human dimension of Torah life. And the Gemara elaborates. In Masechet Avos, we're told that Yafa Sha'achas Ba'olam Hazeh, the Kol Yimos HaMashiach, that's an important creed that we have. Physical life is where the ultimate contest takes place, the capacity to grow and to cultivate spirituality. The source, of course, is in Etatio Dei, Lihidamos, the Rabbono Shalom himself, who is Kadosh, 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 the essence of Kadosh, Kadosh Baruch Hu, Kadosh, 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 referring to his distance, the fact that he is separate from the world, the fact that he is inaccessible to us, Parush, 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 but at the same time, Melo Chol Haaretz Kevodo, he is omnipresent, needs to be omnipresent. Otherwise the world, the physical world, and certainly growth in the physical world, would be impossible. It's important, on the one hand, to engage in Imitatio Dei, Lihidamos, to develop a Prisha part of Kedusha, together with a Melo Chol Haaretz Kevodo, engagement in the real world part of Kedusha. And it's also important to be aware that there are aspects of that dialectic that can only be undertaken by the Rabbono Shel Olam. Again, the Rav, throughout his writings, beautifully depicts this ongoing struggle and dialectic of what he calls, you know, heroism and defeat. People who achieve and become, approximate pinnacles of spiritual success, only to have to withdraw or to be defeated. That's the redemptive process, to imitate the Rabbono Shel Olam and also to know that there are limits to that imitation. Indeed, Rashi, quoting the Sifra, makes famous Kedoshim Tiyu, Prushim, but people misunderstand the significance of that term. They understand it too narrowly as one of fear or one of only limits. They don't understand that Prisha constitutes a gesture of withdrawal, and is also an expression of Kadesh Atzmecha B'mutarlach, to sanctify yourself with that which is permitted. In other words, to take initiative to draw your own lines, not only as self-sacrifice, but especially as the concept of Kedusha is itself a positive concept, sanctity, an ambitious concept. It reflects self-discipline, a bigger perspective, and an investment in spiritualizing human life itself. While Rashi emphasizes Kedoshim Tiyu as Prushim, based on the Sifra, as is well known, the Ramban projects an ambitious idea that Kedoshim Tiyu requires of us to turn halachic norms into values and to integrate our own way of thinking into an almost reflexive approach to life based on those values. Kedoshim Tiyu not as Prushim in the normal sense, but embracing what seems otherwise impossible, but again, what makes life meaningful, a life of Kedusha. The Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvos, in one of the Shirashim, explaining why it is that he doesn't count the mitzvah of Vikidashtem as a separate minyan, a separate mitzvah in the minyan Tayag, explains that the concept of Kedusha is really a mediating concept. It's what allows you to focus on multiple planes, numerous obligations that seemingly pull you in all sorts of different ways. In other words, it's the answer to Greek discreteness. It's the concept of integrity, of integration, of a holistic way of life. Kedoshim Tiyu is Prushim. Kedoshim Tiyu is to identify with values, and Kedoshim Tiyu is the balance and the integration and the projection of a mediating principle that allows for an ambitious, comprehensive spiritual program. Obviously, the views of Rashi, the Ramban, the Rambam, and others, I don't want to go through the whole survey, are not mutually exclusive. On the contrary, they reflect the aspiration of human spirituality, a sanctity that is liberating and that is purposive. If we examine the institutions of Kedusha in the Torah, in the Halacha, we'll see that each of these reflects this dialectic of discipline, but not of asceticism, of ambitious investment and cultivation of human spirituality in one way or another, each one unique to Bechiras Yisrael, to refinement, and to privacy and tznius. True Kedusha Prisha is connected to dignity, privacy, the idea that investing in oneself is an investment in sanctity. The first time we find or encounter Kedusha in the Torah is with respect to Shabbos, right? Right in the very beginning in Bereishis. And that, of course, is the avtipus, it's the paradigm of Kedushas HaZman. Shabbos, of course, highlights this duality. On the one hand, Sheshes Yamim Ta'avod, it's not just to get to Shabbos, it's what validates human creativity at work, living during the secular work week. It's Sheshes Yamim, only because Bayom HaShvi'i Tishbos. And we know that the days of the week revolve around the beginning and the end of Shabbos. Yom Sheni, Yom Shlishi, Yom Shishi, and so on. But it's much more than that. It's the idea that one has to know when to withdraw, and one has to know when to engage. Kivo Shavas Mikol Malachto Asher Baro LeKiv LaAsos. The most creative act in the universe was the creation of the universe by the Ribono Shel Olam. Kivo Shavas Mikol Malachto. Even Kadosh Baruch Hu, Kivyachol, withdrew from the act of creation, from the act of being a borei. It didn't make him less of a borei, but more than a borei, more of a borei. The idea that the koach atzimtzum, that the capacity of prisha, is the ultimate form of gevura, and therefore the ultimate expression of achievement, is something which comes from the world of Shabbos. In Shabbos, there's zachar and shamar. There's an asay, and there's the lav. It's not without good reason that Shabbos is the paradigm of all of Kedushas HaZman. Yom Tov, other things, they're all yonek min HaShabbos. But it's also important for human beings, as much as they imitate the Ribono Shel Olam, Kivot Shavas Mikol Melachto Shabar Lekim La'asos, to know their more obvious limitations and the qualitative difference. Imitatio Dei is a powerful source for Kedusha if we know our limits in that capacity. And that's why there is a Tosefes Shabbos in addition to a Shvisa Shabbos. Not just to make sure, well, that itself would speak volumes. Man's imprecision highlights his limitations. But in addition to that, it's a way of embracing the Prisha and also highlighting the sense of being a Nivra and not a Bore, notwithstanding Imitatio Dei. All these perspectives together, not contradictory, but dimensions of a complex worldview, are embodied in the first Kedusha of the Torah, the Kedusha of Shabbos. As is what might have been the beginning of the Torah, as Rashi, quoting the Medrash in the first Pasuk in Bereishis, tells us, Rosh Chodesh. Is it a coincidence that not only Chilul Shabbos was part of the Yevanim's program, as it was, Gemara and Rosh Hashanah that we read, the Abu Dram's Chukei Ritzonecha, but also Rosh Chodesh? Because Rosh Chodesh, after Shabbos, constitutes man's capacity to be a junior partner with the Ribbono Shel Olam, and even to be Mekadesh, to be Mekadesh as Hazman. Mekadesh Yisrael v'Hazmanim is a very ambitious, it's really even a shocking idea. Very unique to the world of Halacha, to the world of Torah. So the Greeks, as part of their program, took measures to neutralize Shabbos, and even equally to neutralize Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh highlighted the fact that despite man's limitations, he was, within reason, a partner with the Ribbono Shel Olam. And this is true with regard to Milah as well. Milah, of course, represents another first of Kedusha. V'tzetza'ov chasam ba'os bris kodesh. It's interesting. I was giving a shiur, I see some of the people here, a couple of weeks ago in Manhattan. I was talking about gerus and different types of gerus, and I kept using the expression Kedushas Yisrael, what creates or what initiates the Kedushas Yisrael. There was somebody there from Israel in the crowd, and afterwards he came over to me and he said to me, why do you keep saying Kedushas Yisrael? Why don't you just say Shehu Chaver Be'am Yisrael? And I laughed a little bit because a lot of my terminology, I'm happy to say, comes from my Rebbeim, Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal and Aaron Lichtenstein Zatzal. Used to use the expression Kedushas Yisrael to define Jewishness. It's an axiom, and of course, it comes from Mahu Kadosh, Kedoshim Tiyu, Ki Kadosh Hashem Elokecha. When we speak about what it is that uniquely defines someone as a Jew, gives him, invests in him the status of Jewishness, of course, we speak of Kedushas Yisrael. And the first component, for males at least, is the Bris Milah, right? The Tzetzav Chasam Be'os Bris Kodesh. And the first Jew, Avraham Avinu, right? And his children, and the first natural Jew, Yitzchak, Kib Yitzchak Yikare L'Chazara, had to undergo this this Bris Milah. A ger undergoes Bris Milah. What is it about the Bris Milah that justifies its status as a source of Kedusha, sanctity, Kedusha Sisra? And the answer is, of course, again, the same dialectic, this expression of humanity and the capacity to curtail it for the sake of spirituality, but not an ascetic spirituality, but an investment in a spirituality which fuels and ultimately grows because of the humanity. Whole discussion in Gemara Masechet Shabbos and the Rishonim there, and then later in the Mefarshim, and those who wrote about Tamei Mitzvos, whether a milah is a perfection or an imperfection. Medrash quotes the famous exchange of Rabbi Akiva and Tornes Raphus, right? If the Rebbeinu Shalom really wants Mila so much, why weren't all the Jews born Mahol, right? And Rabbi Akiva answers, Letzaref es Abrios. That idea, Letzaref es Abrios, that Torah mitzvos are intended to shape, right, to define, to cultivate Kedusha in Jews, exactly by putting them through their paces in this dialectical way, that first happens in Bris Mila, which is both perfection and imperfection at the same time. We view it as imperfection because it's too much of an absolute expression of man's physicality. The Rambam explains in Mor Nebuchim that symbolically the Bris Mila reflects the inhibition of passion, of pure physicality. The Chinuch says it's an expression of perfection. And as I say, the evidence points to the fact that it's both. Human perfection, human religious perfection, comes when one understands the need for limitations and red lines, and understands that that is not a concession, but on the contrary, it's an investment in a meaningful and a purposive life, in a life which enables one to develop a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, the Kolbo, or Chas Chaim, suggests that Bris Mila played an outsized role in the Hanukkah story. That indeed, they tried to outlaw Mila, and Tmanya Inun, the 8 days of Hanukkah, reflect the concept of Bris Mila and the Kedusha that is part of it. This idea, of course, is inherent also in Kedushas HaMakom. Spoke a little about Kedushas HaAdam and Kedushas HaZman and Kedusha of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What about Kedushas HaMakom? And this, of course, is why the Mikdash is the center of the story of Chanukah. Because it's the epicenter of Hashra'as HaShechina, something else that seems impossible, not just unlikely, but of course is indispensable in Jewish thinkings. Yasisav Yasu LiMikdash V'Shachanti B'Tzalcha. The epicenter of the Shechina in a human setting. B'Timu Kol Hashmanim, the idea of the ethereal aspect of Tumah and Tahara, and especially Shemen and the Menorah and Re'iyah, all of this is part of the Greek behavior or conduct in the Beis HaMikdash. B'Pirtzu Kol HaProtzos, 13 of them, which triggered a response of 13 Hishtachavoyos, according to the Mishnah in Masechet Midos. The idea is, if you look carefully at the Mikdash, the place of the Shechina, is also the most tzanua, in one respect the most accessible, and in another respect the most inaccessible place on the planet. Of course, the most holy place, the Kodesh HaKadoshim, is a place which is visited once a year by one man according to a very strict protocol, the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Being in the Heichal, or voda that takes place in the Heichal, requires that the places that are adjacent to it be emptied out. The idea of avoda in the Mikdash, carried out by an elite group of Kohanim who are trained just for that, B'kol Azar HaKarev, B'kol Zar HaKarev Yumas, reflects this idea of access, intimacy, and Kedusha. When it comes to Kedushas HaMakom, place where really the Ribbono Shel Olam kivyachol resides, the idea of privacy, of tznius, not of transparency, is the dominant theme. Indeed, the Gra suggests that the reason that the protzos, pirtzos, were made in the Soreg, because that was the last place that non-Jews could come. The Mikdash was a place which also highlighted, even as it was accessible to all people in some respects, and to all members of Klal Yisrael, certainly the Azara, but its concentric circles of ever less access and greater intimacy serving all of Klal Yisrael, all of that reflected the special concept of privacy and dignity that is highlighted in Kedushas HaMakom. And the 13 Hishtachavoyos, perhaps, constitute, again, something that only can take place in the Mikdash, that represent kind of a compensation for the protzos within the Mikdash, the ability to do something that typically cannot be done, a way of accessing the otherwise inaccessible Ribbono Shel Olam. The Rambam, in his Igeres HaShmad, says something very curious. It says that the Greeks instituted a gzeira that did not allow people to close their doors of their homes. And consequently, right, they were not able to perform mitzvos. It's often understood that what the Rambam meant was something very pragmatic. But I think that, if you read it, that there is something more profound in what he is saying. And that is that they basically tried to take away privacy. The same impulse that celebrates the ideal human form, right, unclothed, the same impulse that sees man as the center and that suggests that man is the measure of all things, could not abide the notion of tznius, not Nevodas Hashem in the Mikdash, hence all the pirtzos, and certainly not in the private home either. Gemara says in Masechet Bava Basra, I think we have it here, regarding the issue of Hezek Re'iyah, privacy in the halacha, fascinatingly, is called damages. Do we have that?
Yeah.
17. Oh, 17. Because that means we're getting close. Minon emili da'amakra, ma ra'a? Ra'a she'en pischei ahaleyem mechuvanim zelazet. Omar, ru'uyin halalu she'tishra aleyem shchin. He looked around, Matovo Alecha Yaakov. He saw the way that Jewish homes were conducted, that even architecturally and structurally, they were made to protect privacy. And Bilam, against his own will practically, broke out rhapsodically, Matovo Alecha Yaakov Mishkan Osecha Yisrael, said, Ru'uyim Yisrael Shetishra Shchina Beinea. Each of their homes is a kind of mikdash ma'am. Gemara says in Masechet Yoma, very shocking Gemara. Gemara says that the time when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed and pillaged, and they took the Kruvim outside of the Kodesh HaKadoshim and they paraded them through the streets, Gemara says the Kruvim became like almost, to use a modern word, almost pornography in that context. The Kruvim inside the Kodesh HaKadoshim, which represented the apex of Kedusha, outside the framework, outside that private, protocol-laden context, became pornographic. These are the protections, this is the fine line that defines what Kedusha is. Gemara says, in Rosh Hashanah, as we read, they wouldn't allow the expression of Shem Hashem. And then Klal Yisrael went the other way, and the Chachamim brought it back to a certain equilibrium. Shem Hashem, of course, constitutes the ultimate encounter with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Ki Shem Hashem Ekra, Havu Godel Elokeinu. Mar says that's the source for Birchas HaTorah. Ramban says, Kolak, Kola Torah Shemosav Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Basically, the notion that there could be a serious, genuine relationship with a transcendent being, the notion of spirituality, and not a spirituality that could be mocked, not a spirituality that required self-abnegation, rejection of humanity and physicality, but one which elevated it, was something that was so threatening to the Greeks. The idea that Klal Yisrael could invoke a Kodesh Baruch Hu's name, Bechiras Yisrael, Ki Chelak Hashem Amo, Yaakov Chevel Nachal Aso. The Medrash says in Bereishis Rabbah Rav Shimon, this is number 15. Rav Shimon ben Lakish Patar Kariyav of Golios Haaretz Haisatohu Zugolus Bavel Shenem Arisi Haaretzi Neitohu Bo Golus Madai Choshech Zagolus Yavan Shech Shicha Ineim Shal Yisrael Bigzeroseim Shehoiso Meris Lahem Kisval Karen Hashar Ein Lahem Chelek Belokei Yisrael. What was so benighting about Yavan? Kisval Karen Hashar, right on the Karen Hashar. Some of the Parshim says this is a reference to the Egel Hazav. Ein lachem chelek velokei Yisrael. The Ramban, of course, famously in his Perush al HaTorah, zeroing in on the pasuk Kishem Hashem Ekra Havu Godel Elokei. I'm sorry, Kichelek Hashem Amo Yaakov Chevel Nachal Aso, explains that this is the basis for Bechiras Yisrael, for having a unmediated relationship between Klal Yisrael and the Rabbanu Shel Olam. That was something which was not just anathema, but really challenged the very foundations of the whole Greek ideology, essentially. And finally, Kedushas HaIshus, Sheyiboel Lehegemon Tchila. If there's an area in life which in theory, right, could accentuate physicality and the basis of human passions, it's the area of Ishus. The halacha's perspective, of course, is that this is the height of Kedusha. We speak of Kedusha Sa'ishus. The bracha, the Birchas Eirusin that we make under the chuppah, concludes Mekadesh Yisrael, Mekadesh Amo Yisrael, Ayidei Chuppah V'Kedusha. The Gaonim already asked, why is Ishus singled out for this formulation? Asher Kedushanu b'mitzvosa v'tzivanu. Every mitzvah has Kedusha. Why dafka Mekadesh Amo Yisrael Ayidei Chuppah V'Kedusha? But if you read the long, involved, complex Birchas Eirusin, we're not going to do it now. It's been done in this room, I must say. The message, Mitzivanu al arayos, Yasarlanu, making a bracha under the chuppah at a moment of great ecstasy and joy, about to join husband and wife together. And what do we speak about? Mitzivanu al arayos, can't marry this one, can't marry that one, can't marry the next one. Vasarlanu asarusos, there are two stages to Ishus, you have to wait. There's an Erisin, which is more formal, legalistic. Only then do you have a Heterisha Labala, and chuppah. What are you making that speech for? Very, very long bracha. Mekadesh Amo Yisrael Aidei Chuppah V'Kiddush. Yeah, it's just because Ishus, which could have been the most base and crude, is the halacha's target for the most sublime and elevated. In the end, understanding that there are red lines, that there are limits, being selective, having standards, conducting oneself with dignity, protecting all parties in a marriage, their humanity, their dignity, their self-respect, the kiddushin, the ksuva, all of that transforms Ishus into the ultimate symbol of kedusha. When the Greeks wanted to undermine Jewish culture in this Kulturkampf, they went after Bnos Yisrael, and dafka to defile them, instead of Kiddushin Kodem Nisuin, to defile them in the most egregious, in the most evil way possible. Bechiras Yisrael, all of this is reflected ultimately in the menorah. The menorah, as Chazal tells us, represents Torah, Hashkicham Torah Secha, but not just Torah, but Torah Shebal Peh, the interface between the human and the divine, and especially, with all of its different neros, it represents even more so the idea of integration, notwithstanding variety, notwithstanding multidimensionality. That's why the menorah, Pinu Asechalecha, Idliku Neros Bechatzos Kachecha, Neros Tahar, Re'ia, the ethereal aspect, in the Heichal, that private Sanua place which had been breached, constitutes the ultimate symbol for Chanukah. But only a symbol of a period of time to celebrate what truly is unique about Kedushas Yisrael a kedusha of dignity, a dignity of kedusha. The truth is, bayamim ahim bazman azeh. The challenge of cultivating and applying Torah's ambitious doctrine of prisha, kedusha, tzelem elokim, this formula for maximizing specifically human capacity for transcendence and a bond with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Kadosh, 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 Melocha La'aretz Kibodo, is something which is endemic to the human condition in every age. And navigating the dialectic of succumbing to base human nature, aspiring to spirituality and purpose, is hardly simple. It never is. Every generation encounters its own obstacles and its own aids in this quest. Manifesting different motifs of kedusha, prisha, cultivating values, mediation, integration, defeat and victory, imitatio dei, bechiras Yisrael, in turbulent times like our own, is no exception. Our society embraces many positive values that are conducive to this quest. Empathy, a ferocious commitment to fighting injustice, to promoting proper equality, especially of vulnerable populations. All of these are consistent with these themes, admirable qualities that are at aid and in step with the themes of Kedusha. At the same time, just have to pick up the newspaper to be familiar with recent developments, exacerbated by a tyranny of political correctness. Events threaten to undermine the aspiration to spirituality, to purpose, to sanctity, and to dignity. Extreme postmodernism, the sophism of our time, an orientation that borders on that old Greek principle, the frenzied casting aside of foundational norms, they used to call them Judeo-Christian norms, we can call them Jewish norms in this context, and values, definitions that have been prevailing in Western societies for millennia, invoke a new Greek-Rome idea. The embrace of crass and crude language and standards, the magnification of physicality, especially sensualism, is particularly worrisome. And recent events, which need a much more extensive analysis, reveal exactly how deeply flawed these trends are that we are experiencing. While zero tolerance for predatory behavior, harassment, disrespect for boundaries, and red lines are extremely admirable, they're Torah values. They're rather late, and in our society, they ignore the cultural climate on campuses, in general society, especially in the world that is very popular of entertainment, arts, politics, and really even more pervasively, that has fueled some of the more egregious behavior that has been made public or been chronicled publicly, but has sadly been ubiquitous for generations. The juxtaposition of an unprecedented double obituary, lauding as a progressive revolutionary, a person who was one of the most egregious purveyors of pornography and the culture of pure hedonism in our time, exploitation, physical objectification of the human body, male and especially female, with the same newspaper, in the same newspaper, whose admirable campaign of outrage exposing despicable behavior is shocking and sadly telling. These manifestations woefully are mutually exclusive, with Torah values, with the concept of tzniyus, privacy, modesty, sanctity, and dignity. Hezek Re'iyah, as I mentioned, is a critical part of Hashras HaShchina. The Kruvim out of context lose their status and become something totally different. The ethos of the Mikdash, and especially of Ishus, and broadly of Kadoshim Tiyu, never mind Imitatio Dei, Kadosh, 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 obviously contradict all of this. As a society, we'll never progress in the noble battle against impropriety, predator conduct, and just improper behavior by ignoring the cultural climate, which is pervasive and continues to be projected enthusiastically in all sectors of our public arena. As long as we remain inconsistent, it is difficult to believe that true progress will be made. And that is sad, although certainly we should continue to try. We need critically to examine not only egregious crimes after they happen, But the culture, the internet culture of uncritical transparency, of unrefined expression, and hyper self-indulgence and unconstrained hedonism. We cannot promote society with zero red lines, assault age-old pillars of society, at least formally, rhapsodize about unfettered morality at the same time, and prey cynically on people's basest instincts in advertising and media, and then profess shock and chagrin, horror, that outsized egos have overstepped whatever boundaries remain. The crimes are terrible, but progress in neutralizing these problems require a core reassessment of the broader values of society. Finally, sadly but appropriately, my mother, Alea Shalom's last holiday was Hanukkah. Her salient character traits, I would say, were her rare combination of Simchas HaChaim, especially her joy of family, combined with her innate refinement, decency, and dignity. She was somebody who appreciated the sanctity of privacy. She could be appropriately reticent with strangers. She was shy in public. At the same time, full of love and warmth and whimsy to family, to friends, and to acquaintances. She had tremendous respect for people's rights and boundaries. She was mortified by crude manifestations. The Tzelem Elokim in her did not tolerate exhibitionism, excessive physicality, etc. She was particularly allergic to hubris, self-indulgence, and self-aggrandizement, without making speeches about it. At the same time, ascetic impulses were totally foreign to her. She was an adventurous person who really seized life's opportunities intellectually, spiritually, physically. We were recently reminiscing about her whitewater rafting 75th birthday in the Yarden. She was as far as one could be from being an austere person. She was certainly uncomfortable pontificating or lecturing others. But she had an uncanny inner compass as to how to navigate the whole spiritual, physical dialectic. I don't know that she could have articulated it, but she lived it. She was a voracious reader with infectious curiosity and appreciation for the subtle, for the ironic, and the whimsical. She cultivated a deep love and refined taste for music, art, and literature and math. But she particularly reveled in Torah life, in Avas Yisrael, and in Avas Eretz Yisrael. She had a profound impact on us, her family members, simply by virtue of who she was, mostly, I think, without being fully aware of it, aware of that impact. And she continues to be a source of inspiration and a model of Kedushas HaChayim, of the dignity of sanctity and the sanctity of dignity that defines the Yom Tov of Chanukah. Thank you very much. Yehi Zichro Baruch. Thank you.